It just waits on no one. And here we are, almost to the end of June. Just the other day, we were scraping snow from our windshields and putting another log on the fire. Here we are, right in the middle, or right in the beginning, I should say, of summer. But we're halfway through the year. And we're just over a week and a half away from the 4th of July. And the 4th of July is one of my favorite worldly holidays, if you will. I appreciate what it pictures and everything that goes with that. And we're thinking about the 4th of July, you know, this country wasn't just founded on freedom and religion without a battle. You know, there were battles to get where we are today. And with that thought in mind, it's pretty exciting to read back through the Bible and look at the battles through the Bible. Not just the battles, but the victories that God gave His people in the majority of these battles. Not all of them, but the majority of them. Because sadly, there are some battles throughout the Bible where God's people did not come out victorious. Not in the beginning, or not after the first battle. But they continued on. And we're going to look at that today. But when we think about the Israelites and God's people throughout time, you know, they are a tough people. And I like to think that we are a tough people. And the battles that we face, we can learn from our ancestors and go on. Not just go on, but go on with victory. So today, I'd like to take a look at seven different battles. Seven different battles from mostly from the Old Testament. And in these, look at the lessons. There's many lessons, but there's one common factor in all these battles. And I'm not going to tell you what it is just yet, but I'm sure probably after we look at the first battle, you'll pick up on it, and we'll go from there. But I want to take these seven battles and look at them. Now, it won't be a deep analysis, because we don't have time for that, but it'll be a quick highlight of these battles. Now, we think about the battles in the Bible. You know, we're probably familiar with all these battles that we're going to talk about today. And some of them are very famous, like the Battle of Jericho, the Battle of David and Goliath. And then there's others that maybe aren't quite as known, you know, about the battle with the Philistines capturing the Ark. That's just name three of them that we're going to talk about. So let's go ahead and start. If you will, let's turn to Joshua as we start. Joshua chapter 5 is where we will begin. And we want to start with the Battle of Jericho. And again, there's lessons we can learn. You know, when we think about the Battle of Jericho, and we know a lot about it, but Joshua led the children of Israel back across the Jordan River. He done this to take them into the Promised Land. The Promised Land that they have been promised for several years. They were wandering in the wilderness for over 40 years, waiting for this time, this moment. The first obstacle they faced was the city of Jericho. Now, this large walled city, very formidable, it was there, but they had to take it. They knew through the work of spies that the people of Jericho were somewhat afraid of the Israelites. They didn't really know a whole lot about the Israelites, but they feared them. Joshua received his marching orders from an appearance of the captain of the Lord of hosts. The captain of the Lord of hosts. We know this to be Christ. Christ gave Joshua a message. Now this message was that the Hebrew military would march around the city once a day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, would march around it seven times. So let's go ahead and pick up the story. I want to actually start here in Joshua 5 and verse 13. Now, as Mr. Shoemaker read from the Amplified Version, I'm going to read from the New International Version. It makes it just a little bit more clear. Joshua 5, starting at verse 13. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." Then Joshua fell face down on the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" Now, there's a couple of reasons we know that this was Christ talking to him. Number one is Joshua fell down and he worshiped. The idea of what we see here, what we're starting to see. Now, we won't turn there, but if you go back in Revelation, you know that John worshiped or done the same thing to an angel, and the angel set him straight. He said, listen, you know, I am not the one you need to worship. God the Father is. We don't see that here. But it goes on in verse 15. The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy. We hear that one other time, back when Moses went to stand before the Lord. And Joshua did so. Now, go to chapter 6 here, in verse 1. Now, the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites. No one went in or out or in. In verse 2, then the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its kings and its fighting men. March around the city once with all your armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the walls of the city will collapse and the army will go up, everyone straight in. Well, the plan was laid out. He told Joshua exactly what to do. And following God's plan, the children of Israel defeated Jericho. They went in, they done exactly as God commanded, and they came out victorious. After they marched around the city, again, according to every instruction of God, the walls did fall down. Israel entered the city, and they took the city as their first victory, the first victory in this new promised land that they were inheriting. And this is a great victory for God's people. Now, we did touch on one of the common factors there. But before we go any further on that, I'm going to go to our next battle. Our next battle, because it takes off of this one. And it's actually in Joshua chapter 7, but we'll get that in just a minute. This is the battle of the city of Ai. Immediately following the battle of Jericho, the Israelites, they went to the city of Ai. Now, the whole army didn't go. And they didn't go because this was a much smaller city than Jericho. However, as they did this, as just part of them went, they were turned away from this small city. When they hit it, they went in and they thought they had this. They knew that this won't be a problem at all. Well, 36 Hebrews died in that battle because they didn't exactly do, or we'll see in a minute, God's plan wasn't followed to the T. Let's go ahead and look at Joshua chapter 7, starting in verse 3. Joshua chapter 7 and verse 3. We're going to see how Jericho and the city here of Ai come together. In verse 3 here, when they returned to Joshua, they said, not all the army will have to go up against Ai. Send 2,000 or 3,000 men to take it, and do not weary the whole army, for only a few people live there. So about 3,000 went up, but they were routed by the men of Ai, who killed about 36 of them. They chased Israelites from the city's gate as far as the stone quarries and struck them down on the slopes. At this, the hearts of the people melted in fear and became like water. So now we need to look back just for a minute at Jericho and understand the parallel we see here. You know, God revealed to Joshua that there was sin in the camp. Now, Joshua wasn't aware of this at the time, because they went from Jericho in a victory, at least that's what it seemed like in the front, a victory, into taking this next battle where they had some casualties. A man named Achan had taken gold, silver, and garments from Jericho. Let's drop down to verse 20, Joshua chapter 7 and verse 20. Achan replied, "It is true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I have done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They are hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." So what we have to understand here is, according to God's plan, right off the bat from Jericho, the first obstacle that the children faced, the plan was all of the spoils of Jericho, all, every last spoil of Jericho was to be dedicated to God. After that, God planned to allow the children of Israel to keep all future spoils. But the only rule he had was the first, go to him. One of the lessons or parallels that we can see from this in our own life is that we have to understand that the first of anything that we gain, tithes, offerings, the first goes to God. The first goes to God. And then as we do this, God is apt to bless us. And he says, "I'll bless you beyond what you can count or carry or handle." Maybe not handle, but what you are used to. It would be overwhelming, the blessings that God gives us, if we do what he says first. Then we go on here and we see that there's consequences for past sin. The city of Ai here, when they was kind of maybe puffed up a little bit by thinking that we don't need all the help, we can take the city, they lost a little over 10% of the men that went in, or not 10%, but 1% of the men that went in to take this city. And if they would follow God's laws, God's rules in the beginning, they wouldn't have had to have any sacrifices of their own people. But what we see here is they didn't. And now they have sinned. And now there's consequences for sin. Now we all know that when we repent of our sins are forgiven and we can move on. Nowhere here does it say, and Achan here does not even let us know that he repented. He doesn't tell us that. So because of this, there's consequences for this sin. And we see what they are. We're starting to see here that when Achan stole all that was God's, had been dedicated to God, had been set apart for God, God brought judgment on him and all the people. And we have to think about that, because this parallels our life too. You know, if we sin and we are not repentant of our sins, then the consequences will start to magnify. And they won't just affect us, but they affect our loved ones, our friends and families. And that's how it's set up here. And then Achan and all and everything that he owned, he was stoned and everything was burned. So God took care of the situation. Let's look at Joshua 7 here, verse 25. Joshua 7, verse 25, he explains this. Joshua said, "Why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble upon you, or on you today." Then all of Israel stoned him, and after they stoned the rest, they burnt them. Sin does not go unpunished. And we have to understand that. And I know we do, but it's good to go back and review that. Sin does not go unpunished. Because sin can creep in such small, minute amounts. But when it does, then it grows. And if we don't get rid of it immediately, it can fester, and then it can become such a sore that something has to be removed. So now we see here that Israel, once again, marched against the city. We're going to look at this in just a minute. But they went back to march against the city of Ai again. Now, remember the sequence here. They've already, through God's blessing, they've already taken care of the sin, the problem. So they marched against the city again, and a part of the army presented themselves to the fronts of the walls or the gates of the city of Ai. And when the men of Ai came out against the Israelites again, the Israelites fled in retreat. Now, it kind of sounds like the same thing we just read, but there's a little bit of difference this time. This time, their retreat, the Israelites' retreat, was a planned ambush. Let's look at this in Joshua 8, verses 3 through 8. Joshua 8, starting at verse 3. So Joshua and the whole army moved out to attack Ai. He chose 30,000 of his best fighting men and sent them out at night with these orders. This is what he told them. He instructed them, "Listen carefully. You are to set an ambush behind the city. Don't go very far from it. All of you be on the alert. I and all those with me will advance on the city. And when the men come out against us, as they did before, we will flee from them. They will pursue us until we have lured them away from the city, for they will say, 'They are running away from us as they did before.' So when they flee from them, you are to rise up from your ambush and take the city. The Lord your God will give it into your hands. When you have taken the city, set it on fire. Do what the Lord has commanded. See to it, you have my orders." So now we see that once they have revealed the sin has been taken care of. And once they've decided to listen to God in every detail of His orders, they had victory. And again, that goes hand in hand for us today. We live in this world. This world is a world of sin. We have to live in this world, but we don't have to be a part of it. But while we're here, we have to be careful that little things don't come in our lives. Little things that are sin in nature and root and take hold and grow. Because if they do, we could end up, you know, like Achan here. We could lose our focus for just a few minutes, and we can end up being stoned and being burnt. We don't want that to happen. Let's go to our next battle. And this is one of my favorite battles, and I'm sure most of you like appreciate this one too. It's the battle that Gideon was a part of. And Judges here. Judges 6. Now, God sent an angel here to speak to Gideon. Now, Gideon was out gathering wheat. Israel had been surrounded by the armies of the Midianites and been cut off from their supplies. Gideon was working diligently when he got this very, very life-changing, important message from God. God wanted Gideon to lead the armies against the Midianites, and he's coming to Gideon. He's asking Gideon to take charge. Now, there's a couple lessons we can learn right off the bat here, because Gideon was very humble, and that's the perfect lesson for us. To be humble in everything that we do. Gideon was very humble by this personal request from God. Now, if we're thinking that the only way we can be humble is by having a personal request from God, then we have it. That's what we have to understand. God has given us a personal request, and that is to be invited into His family, live His way of life, and promote His way of life. That's a very humbling request. God's given that to us. But here in Gideon's case, although he considered himself not worthy to do this, he agreed to let God lead him. And that's another lesson. We have to agree to let God lead us. We have to have humility, and then we have to allow God to take that humility and work with it and let it grow. And then through God, or you know, God through us, He will do amazing things. Judges 6 here, starting at verse 12. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Now, this kind of goes to Gideon's humility. He said, "Pardon me, Lord." Gideon replied, "But if the Lord is with us, Why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hands of the Midian. Verse 14. The Lord turned to him and said, go in strength, you have, and save Israel out of Midian's hands. Am I not sending you? So he replied back. Now listen to Gideon's reply again. Pardon me, my Lord. Gideon replied, but how can I save Israel? Now remember that quote. How can I save Israel? He goes on to say, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. The Lord answered, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive. So, again, we see the second lesson is that we have to understand, no matter what we are asked to do, no matter how big it seems, with God, we can do it. With God, all things are possible. And we're about to see the outcome of what happened here at Gideon. Now, I think it's kind of neat that, you know, Gideon is humble. And we see that throughout this message here. But he asked God, but how can I save Israel? So he might not have been thinking all the way through the situation that was going on here. Because we see what's about to happen. You know, Gideon gathered all his men together to go against the Midians. His army numbered 32,000 men. That's not a bad size army. But guess what? God said that's way too many. That's way too many. Gideon invited, understanding what God said, and God is in charge, Gideon invited all those that were afraid and that had second doubts to go ahead and go back home, and there'll be no repercussions. No problem. This is probably what amazed Gideon. 22,000 of his 32,000 left. How would you feel if you were the commander of an army and two-thirds of your men left? Now, get this. God said, you have 10,000 left. That's still way too many. Wow. At this point, you would have to really, really have faith in God. God instructed Gideon to take the remaining to a place and to get a drink of water. Let's pick up on this story here. Judges 7, verse 4. Judges 7, starting in verse 4. But the Lord said to Gideon, there are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will thin them out for you there. If I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go. So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, separate those who lap the water with their tongues as a dog laps from those who kneel down to drink. 300 of the men drank from cupped hands, lapping like dogs. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. Verse 7, the Lord said to Gideon, with 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the others go home. Now we see the difference between the verse 7 statement and what we read in verse 15 of the previous section of Scripture, where Gideon said, but how can I save Israel? Well, as God said, with these men, he said, I, God, will save you and give the Midianites into your hand. So we see, who's in charge? You know, and it's human nature to think that we can do it. We can do it. We are in charge. But God's in charge. The bottom line is God's in charge. Most of these men fell down to their knees and their stomachs even to drink the water as deep as they could. And doing this, they had no clue what was going on around them. You know, when your face is buried in a water hole, you don't know what's coming from you. Side, back, front, you don't know. But the 300 men that got down and scooped up water and could drink it and look around, they were aware. And that's what God was looking for. Men who were aware of their surroundings. The men who could see the enemy coming. This is exact parallel for us today. God wants us to drink, but he wants us to be aware of our surroundings. Be aware of the enemy, because the enemy is out there. He wants us to always be vigilant. That's what he was telling Gideon, to test the men, to make sure that they are vigilant, and only those could go against the Midians. So while it was good that Gideon was given the best soldiers of the starting 32,000, they were down to 300. So I can imagine if Gideon was a little shocked and disappointed before, what he must be feeling now. But the bottom line is, God is in charge. But this is the key. This is the key to this. God assured Gideon. He assured Gideon that the battle would be won by the Lord and not by men. And he made sure Gideon understood this. And God did it his way. He did it by, when man would look at this, man would think the numbers are so overwhelming that it couldn't happen. And because of that, that's why God did it this way, to prove that he is in charge. And if we have faith in him, then we will win. We will survive. And that was what he was telling Gideon here. When he used these 300 men, you know, these 300 men were merely tools, tools in God's hands. And that's exactly what we are. We are tools in God's hands. When we look at how many of us there are in God's true church, that's not many compared to what the world has, the population of the world. We are tools in God's hands. So standing over the hills of the camp of 135,000 men that they were going to go up against, 300 men going up against, well, I assume it's 301 now, if you count Gideon. But they were going up against these 135,000 men of the army of the Midianites. That would be overwhelming. But God told them, he said, you know, be assured that his promises are true. And that's what he tells us. His promises to us are true. He told Gideon, he said, take a couple men and go down to the camp here, sneak in, and listen to these men tell about a dream that they had. So they did this, and one of the men dreamed, was talking to the other about this large loaf of barley that rolled down the hill and crushed them all. They were telling about this. Then the other man decided that he would interpret this vision as Gideon coming through and wiping out the 135,000. When Gideon and his guys heard their enemies talking about this, it gave them encouragement. It gave them it might have strengthened their faith a little bit. But regardless, they took this back to their 300 men, and they told about it, and they talked about it, and they were encouraged. So they encouraged the others. And this was a good thing. And you can read more about this. We won't do it now. But in Judges 7, 9 through 15, goes on through the story. But Gideon, then, so he comes back to camp, and now they're preparing for this battle coming up. So Gideon equipped his men with trumpets, clay pots, and lanterns. That doesn't seem like much to go into battle with. But when you only have 300 guys, who knows, you know, who knows what can happen? But you have God on your side, and that's the main thing. So at Gideon's signal, they broke their pots all simultaneously. Imagine what that may have sounded like. All this glass and clay just shaking and cracking, and it probably sounded pretty overwhelming. And at the same time, they blew on the horns. So we were starting to see maybe, you know, what the magnifications here would have been. The men of Media were so startled. They were this was night. They were asleep. They were so startled and so confused by this noise that they jumped up and they started killing each other. God had a plan. Only of the 135,000, there was 15,000 that escaped. 15,000. They all killed each other in confusion. The parallel here is if we don't stay focused, Satan will use those same tactics on us to confuse us. And then we kill each other. That's what he wants. We cannot allow that to happen. We have to put God first, no matter what. God first. And when we depend on God, he will give us the clay pots and the horns that we need to go through and win the battle. There was no question that God gave the 300 men, the army of Israel, victory over the 135,000. Absolutely no question at all. God gives us the same victory in our lives. And we can rest assured that as long as we stay with God and don't turn our back on God, that victory will always be there. Let's go to our next battle here. And this is the one we mentioned earlier. The Philistines take the ark. Now, this is found in 1 Samuel 4. Now, I'm making this real easy for you. We're starting and just going right through the Bible. We're not jumping around a whole lot. 1 Samuel 4. Now, Israel battled the Philistines often throughout the Bible. We can read a lot of accounts of this. But here in 1 Samuel 4, the Philistines overcame Israel, and they killed about 4,000 of the Israelites. Well, as we read in Jericho, the Israelites got killed. There was sin involved. And we'll take a look at this and see what we come up with here. 1 Samuel 4, starting in verse 2. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. And as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. Now Israel went on to seek out the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh. That's where it was located, because they were convinced that the presence of this ark would protect them. Now let's go on here, verse 3. Let's continue on down through the story a little bit. Verse 3 says, "When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, 'Why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh, so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies.' So the people sent men to Shiloh, and they brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. When the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came to the camp, into the camp, all Israel..." Now pay attention to this. "All Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook." What we see here is that they trusted in the ark more than God. When the ark arrived at camp, the Israelites cheered so loudly that the Philistines wondered what was taking place. They heard all this commotion and excitement going on. The Philistines learned that the ark was coming into camp. Now, you have to understand that the Philistines had never experienced God's presence directly. And they had heard stories about God and the ark and what could happen. And all these stories frightened them. It scared them a little bit. So they recounted to one another how that God had done mighty works through the children of Israel throughout time with the ark. How they brought them from Egypt's bondage. And they thought nobody could do that. But they knew that God did. They knew about these stories and they knew about other stories. So, not wanting to become servants of Israel, of the Israelites, the Philistines fought even harder. They killed 30,000 Israelites infantry. 30,000. And that's found in 1 Samuel 4, verse 10, if you want to use that for a reference. But besides losing the ark and the sons of Eli, the high priest, they were killed in this battle as well. So let's pick up the story here in verse 6. 1 Samuel 4, starting in verse 6. "Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, 'What's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp?' When they learned that the Ark of the Covenant had come into camp, the Philistines were afraid. 'A god has come into the camp,' they said. 'Oh no. Nothing like this has ever happened before. We're doomed. Who will deliver us from the hands of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Be strong, Philistines. Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight. Verse 10. So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So what we see here, again, Israel, God's people, when you look back at the very story of the Exodus, how many times can we go back and look? God delivered, they stood up to the challenge, and then they doubted. God delivered them again, they stood up to another challenge, and they doubted. So much so that that first generation could not enter the promised land. We see the same thing happening again. The Israelites trusted in the mere presence of the ark, and what they needed to trust was the presence of God. And they didn't. They doubted. And this is a very, very crucial lesson for us today. If we are not 100% committed to trusting God and living His way of life, then we will be overtaken. We have to have 100% commitment. There's no other choice. Let's go to our fifth battle. This is a battle of Saul against the Amalekites. It's in 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15. You know, Samuel gave up the battle plan to King Saul for fighting against the Amalekites here. The armies of Israel were to battle the Amalekites and King Agag to death. Not be captured, but to death. They were not to bring anything at all back. Let's start in 1 Samuel 15 here, starting in verse 3. Now go, attack the Amalekites, and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. In other words, everything. Leave nothing. So what we see here, Saul led an army of 210,000 men. But Saul and the people did not obey God. They did not obey what was coming down here. They spared King Agag and the best of the animals. They picked out the quality and they spared them. Now, these animals, according to Saul and his people, were supposedly going to be used for sacrifice to God. Let's continue on in verse 9 here. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fatted calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak they totally destroyed. Now let's drop down to verse 14 here and see what happens. But Samuel said, "What then is this bleeping of sheep in my ears? What is the lowing of cattle I hear?" He wasn't supposed to hear any of this. I mean, that wasn't the plan. That wasn't the orders. The orders were to kill everything. He's hearing animal sounds. Verse 15. Saul answered. Now, listen to how Saul explains this. Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to whose God? Your God." He made this personal. To your God. Now, look what he says in the final statement here. But we totally destroyed the rest. What we see here is he's trying to step out of the blame at all. He says, the soldiers, not soldiers in my command or my soldiers or even our soldiers. He says, the soldiers, them old soldiers. Then he goes on to say, they spared. Not we, but they spared it. And then he goes on to say, your God. Well, he's our God. It goes to push blame. But then he finally says, where he thought he could get a little credit, a little pat on the back, he says, but we destroyed the rest. Well, that, he missed the whole point. That wasn't the orders. The orders were to destroy everything. When Samuel found out that God's orders were not obeyed, he became very angry. He became very angry with Saul because Saul was in charge. Saul offered excuses that we just read. He said that it was the people who made the decision and that the animals, they were saved for a good cause, for a sacrifice to your God. Samuel told Saul that God, and this is extremely important for all of us, God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. We have to understand that. And you can look that up in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 22. Samuel called for King Agag. He said, "Bring him to me. We're going to settle this." Now the Bible says that Agag came into the presence of Samuel very cautiously. And I can imagine why. Because we know what the orders were, and I'm sure the king here knew what the orders were. So he came into the presence very cautiously, and he was hoping that his life might be spared. That's 1 Samuel 15, verse 32. But within moments, just a few moments, Samuel declared that King Agag had caused many women to be childless. So his mother was about to become childless too. Let's look at that. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 33. 1 Samuel 15 verse 33. But Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so will your mother be childless among women." And Samuel put Agag to death before the Lord of Gilgal. The bottom line is, God expects each and every one of us to obey Him 100%. He says, for anyone who breaks one of my commandments is guilty of all of them. He doesn't say, go ahead and break one, or, you know, we like to say we don't break the rules, but we might fraction a little bit. Well, that's not acceptable to God. God expects obedience all the time. And it's hard to do. But we have to try to do this. It doesn't matter if we think that we have a better idea. Because, as the cliche says, we're not Ford. We don't have a better idea. God has the better idea. And that's what we have to rely on and depend on. God does have the best idea, and God knows best. And we have to rely on that. We have to have faith to know that. Let's move on to battle number 6. Battle number 6 is a very familiar battle. In 1 Samuel 17 is where we'll start this one. And this is David and Goliath. Now probably this is the best known battle in the Bible. When we start talking about, you know, battles, and one of the first ones we probably learn as a small child is David and Goliath. Here we see a small shepherd boy going up against a well-trained military machine. And that's basically how we describe it. They met when David came to the camp to bring supplies to his brothers. His brothers were engaged in this battle, soldiers against soldiers, a blood battle. It was about to go really bad. They were up against the Philistines, the enemies, and it was tough. Goliath came to the front, and we all know the story. But he came to the front lines, and he declared that he would go one-on-one with anyone who dared to face him. Anyone. He didn't care who it was. And you have to understand, Goliath was a giant. He was a huge man. And with all the armor on him, he probably looked even bigger. So when we say he was a military machine, he really was. Goliath challenged the very faith of not just David's God, but our God. The very faith that the Israelites had in God. He threw it in her face. Goliath did not believe in this God, and therefore he mocked God in front of the Israelites. He did this, and he didn't think twice about it. And then he said, "Anyone man enough to challenge me, come on." So let's start it here in 1 Samuel 17, verse 8. Starting at verse 8. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. David took the challenge and prepared to fight Goliath. Think about this. A little shepherd boy. You know, the Bible talks about David. He didn't have a very big structure. But he did have a big attitude. A faithful attitude. And that was an attitude towards God. And he wasn't going to let anybody at all talk about his God. That's a lesson that we need to take to heart. We don't let anybody talk about our God. Our God is great and powerful and above anything in this world. Anything. That's the attitude that David had. King Saul should have been out there fighting, standing up for God. He said, "Here, David, you can have my royal armor." David said, "No, I don't need your royal armor to fight this giant." He said he would trust in God, God of Israel, who had saved him from lions and bears. He said, "That same God will save me from this Goliath." And that's in verse 32 through 39. So we know the rest of the story. David carefully chose 5 stones from the stream. 5 stones. And then he grabbed them and he charged Goliath. Now Goliath was amazed to see such a young, small boy come bravely towards him. David fit a stone in his sling and he hurled it and he let it go right at Goliath. God guided that rock and it struck Goliath between the eyes. David took the sword of Goliath after Goliath hit the ground and he cut Goliath's head off. And I'll just read the rest of this because it's very, very important to see the lesson of David's attitude that we can get from this. This is 1 Samuel 17, starting in verse 40. The attitude is great. Starting in verse 40. "Then he took his staff in his hand. He chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in hand, he approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsomeness, and he despised him." Now, I'm taking from this that maybe Goliath wasn't the best-looking guy in the world. So, verse 43. "He said to David, 'Am I a dog that you can come at me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his God." He just kept adding fuel to the fire. Verse 44. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild beasts," or wild animals. Now, today's language, we call that trash talking. That's exactly what Goliath was doing. He was trying to get in David's head. Now, he knew David was a small guy, and he didn't really fear him. So now he was belittling the situation. Now we're about to see that the most important part of this battle takes place. Verse 45. "David said to the Philistine, 'You come against me with a sword and a spear and a javelin.'" Now this is the part we need to pay attention to. "But I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you defied." Verse 46. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcass of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel." He kind of had a little trash talk of his own going on here. In verse 47, "All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle of the Lord's, and for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." As the Philistines moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. Verse 50. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of a Philistine's sword and drew it from the sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. They fled, and Israel pursued. We see the very example of trust, faith, commitment, hope, dedication. We can go on and on. To God, to God's way of life, and the victory that comes from that. You know, we all may face battles in our own life, and we all may have temporary setbacks. But the true battle will be won by God. And we get to be a part of that. God won a great victory here in the Israelites through that day there when David stood up and said, "This is my God. I'm proud of him. He's my father, and I won't back down." We have to say the very same thing. It doesn't get any truer than that right there. We can't back down. Let's look at our last battle. And this is a battle that hasn't happened yet. Let's go to Revelation chapter 19. Revelation chapter 19. A battle that is coming, that is rapidly approaching, and it will be the war to end all wars. Revelation 19. "Now after the return of Christ and a great tribulation, Jesus Christ himself will lead an army to the battle of what we are familiar with as the Battle of Armageddon. Christ and his armies will descend on white horses. And that's going to be an amazing sight to see. They're going to battle against the beast, the false prophet, and all those kings who doubted. The rulers and leaderships who doubt, who reject God, reject Christ, and they're going to win. Revelation 19, starting at verse 11. "And I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and wages war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but he himself. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. The armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses and dressed in fine linen, white and clean." So we see Christ and his armies, they fight with swords, and they emerge victorious. This is the future. This is what's coming. The beast and the false prophet, they'll be taken and cast into the lake of fire. Let's finish this up in Revelation 19, verses 20 and 21. "But the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet who had performed the signs on its behalf. With these signs, he deluded those who had received the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. The two of them were thrown alive into the fiery lake of burning sulfur. The rest were killed with a sword coming out of the mouth of the riders on the horse, and all the birds gorged themselves on their flesh." We see this battle that is coming, and we're warned that we do not have to be a part of this battle, at least on the losing end. We have to make the choice today to stay committed, to stay the course, to keep the faith. And by doing that, we can emerge victorious, not just this battle coming, but all the battles we face today in our personal life. So I hope, brethren, that we can see the common factor that we've talked about. We've talked about a lot of lessons, but the common factor in all of these battles, and the common factor in the battle to come. And that common factor is 100% committal and obedience to God. We have to stay obedient if we expect to emerge victorious. We have to put God's way of life into our hearts and our minds. And we have to do this without a second thought. It has to become second nature. Just do it. And when we do this, we will have victory over anything that lies ahead in this world. And that's a promise from God. We can read it in the Bible, and God's word is true. So let's remember the battles that we looked at today. And let's remember the common factor, the obedience to God, the commitment to God. Let's always keep that on our minds. Let's not lose that. And let's put our total trust, faith, and commitment and obedience in Jesus Christ and God the Father. And when we do that, we can and will endure to the end.